I would now like to introduce the panel and the panel's individual responses to the film, Remembering the Infantile, which I hope everyone has been able to view. I first encountered the film dramatization of Bion's A Memoir of the Future 5 years ago in Reading, England. Meg Harris-Williams showed the sequences as they then existed, pausing between them to read unfilmed parts of the script and to comment on their context in relation to Bion's autobiographical writings and ideas. From these fragments of scenes, and from Meg's interjections and responses to questions from the floor, I received an impression in a way that moved me and clearly moved the audience of Bion's mind with its unexpected shifts between narrated experience, scenes from childhood, and fictitious imagined encounters with internal objects. Here was a sense of the complex humanity of this thinking, feeling, and most importantly, questioning man. Since then, the film has grown, and the full-length version now runs to an hour and a quarter, from which Meg has produced this 30-minute version. Her piecing together of this film in its various editions has truly been a labour of love, born of her intimate involvement in its genesis and her deep knowledge of Bion's work. It is a great privilege and pleasure to introduce this panel, in which Meg is joined by Vero Montagna in Sao Paulo, Brazil, and Vivian Pasica from Toronto, Canada. Each will respond to the film from their different subjective points of view. Their thoughts span Bion's own work, especially the memoir of the future, as well as that of Martha Harris, Esther Bick, and Donald Meltzer. But they go beyond the psychoanalytic literature to poetry, philosophy, linguistics, and art, to the novels of Proust and Joyce and the stories of Borges, and to the places that in Neolithic and ancient history cradle our earliest notions of the mind and the imagination. Their rich associations, like the film, evoke what Vero Montagna calls thought ruins, primitive relics of thought that dreamed aright, moved the infant ego to learn from experience in a continuous and never-ending process of mental life. These presentations will be followed by a panel discussion, after which we hope to hear your own responses, thoughts, and questions. We begin then with Meg Harris-Williams, a visual artist, a writer, and also a teacher of psychoanalytic ideas, focusing on the nature of aesthetic experience and the links between psychoanalysis and the arts, especially literature. Her books include The Veil of Soul-Making, The Post-Kleinian Model of the Mind, The Aesthetic Development, The Poetic Spirit of Psychoanalysis, and The Art of Personality in Literature and Psychoanalysis. She was co-author with Donald Meltzer of The Apprehension of Beauty. In Bion's Dream, she wrote about Bion's autobiography, A Memoir of the Future, for which she also wrote the film script, together with Kumar Shahani. More recently, she wrote the script for The Becoming Room, based on that film, which was performed in Delhi by Tom Alter in 2017. Her latest book is Dream Sequences in Shakespeare, and some of you, like me, will come to this from her session on the infant's bond with the absent mother in King Lear. So, Meg, will you begin?
Well, thank you, Alison, for that introduction. And I'd now just like to say a few words about how this little film came into existence, and then how it relates to the topic of this conference on the infantile. Many years ago, as Alison said, in the 1980s, in fact, I was involved in making a film about Bion's memoir of the future with the Indian director, Kumar Shahani, a project that was planned before Bion's death and was originally intended as a documentary and discussion with Bjorn himself, who had agreed to go to India to do it. The land of his childhood, of course, which he had not revisited since leaving it for school in England at the age of 8. After Bjorn's sudden death, the idea turned to making a drama of the memoir itself. That film was never finished for many reasons, but it had a wonderful cast of actors who retained a special affection for it. And about 5 years ago, one of them, Tom Alter, asked me to write a short play based on the film that he could include in his series of one-man plays, The Play of History, which was about figures with an Indian connection. Tom Alter is an Indian actor, or was an Indian actor. He died 3 years ago. So this play and the video that was filmed at its performance in Delhi in 2017 was called The Becoming Room, and it can be watched on YouTube. Today's film, Remembering the Infantile, is a selection of scenes from The Becoming Room, focusing on Bjorn's childhood experiences and how they become transformed or translated in the process of remembering throughout life, and especially in the process of his own self-analysis. The film was never intended to be a literal biography of Wilfred Bjorn. He was a very private person whom none of us can know, and his actual life is really of no interest to us. We were not there and it is none of our business. After teaching a course on psychoanalytic autobiography for many years, I've become increasingly aware of the difference between biography and autobiography. As Bjorn points out at the beginning of The Long Weekend, he is not writing about the real people, places, or events in which his life story took place or seems to take place. He says, writing about me. That is his inner self, not his outer self. All the characters, however realistic, are fictional, and they represent aspects of his own mind. This means that we can identify with them from a learning point of view. They become internal objects of our own. It's an interesting feature of autobiography that it always seems to be about ourselves. This is regardless of the fact that everyone's life circumstances are different. Their internal struggle for development encounters the same obstacles owing to what is unfashionably termed human nature. Unfashionable, yet psychoanalysis is based on this premise of common humanity, not just in the political sense of the rights of man, but his psychic experience. So we identify intimately with the writer of an autobiography, by contrast with a biography in which there is a temptation to believe in the illusion that we are possessed of the facts about somebody else's experience. A temptation described in psychoanalysis as countertransference action, in this case usually taking the form of possessiveness about understanding Bjorn, the new messiah, as my mother Martha Harris predicted this phenomenon. So it is with Bjorn's autobiography. Because it is his dream about himself, not a portrait of his actual parents or friends, it is also about us, if we can see ourselves there, which means we have to undergo our own subjective experience in the manner of the analyst's useful countertransference, called by Meltzer the countertransference dream. Indeed, the title The Becoming Room was chosen because this project of filming the memoir had, for those of us involved in it, taken on a lifetime quality. The cutting room where films are edited was getting associated with the becoming room of life, on the lines of Bjorn's description of himself as perpetually becoming a psychoanalyst, but never reaching the goal. Such is real life. Bjorn's Indian childhood, his school days, his war experience, narrate a sequence of internal dramas, that focus above all the struggle of how the child or infant aspect of the self learns to think or is distracted from thinking. As a child, the objects who promote or sometimes unintentionally thwart this developmental struggle are inevitably his parental and family figures. Here, his father, mother, and Aya, that's his nurse. In a sense, he had two mothers, representing two directions and two sets of values, the Indian and the British or British Raj, the female emotional or religious and the male scientific. They seem incompatible, and yet he suspects they have a hidden link. And as always in his thinking, the link is the key to the situation. The problem is how to deal with hidden emotional turbulence when it becomes noticeable. How to gather different parts of the personality into a work group rather than avoiding the experience by sheltering in a basic assumption group, which is always a false exoskeleton rather than helping to develop a true endoskeleton, as he puts it. So the film is an attempt to visualize the growth of an idea and the growth of a thinking process or capacity to think, to convert intolerable or incomprehensible sensations into material for thinking about them. For Bion, every thought has a prenatal origin, just as every human being does. So the scenes from the film are not truly chronological, although there is an underlying structure of a life story from birth to death of an individual, as he describes it in the memoir. But they are more dreamlike in the way that they switch from one time to another. What they're really hoping to dramatize is this attempt to evolve a work group from the interaction of internal objects. The central events of childhood are really metaphors for internal group meetings. The tiger hunt, the train, electric city, the run. Hence we have Krishna and Christ, the devil and the virgin, the green hill of sacrifice. These conflicts represent the positions and processes defined by Bion as pairing, dependence, and fight flight, and the movement towards K, knowledge, or away from it to minus K. Throughout, there is a dialogue or caesura between prenatal and postnatal perspectives. The prenatal is always complaining that the postnatal, however clever it believes itself to be, is unable to feel the feelings that it is trying to get across. So the film both begins and ends with an image of the birth of its subject, Wilfred Bion. The second birth revisits or remembers the first traumatic caesura from a watery to a gaseous way of being, and tries to shed new light on this catastrophic change to make it constructive rather than destructive. On one level, the whole story can be seen as a dramatization of his grid. Bion often says, as he does in the film, that he feels his main difficulty in communicating his ideas is conveying his belief that the mind is a real place, not just a way of talking. He says, "How can I explain that I really think there is a mind?" It seems that he chose the medium of autobiography at the end of his life, not so much to convey any special message about psychoanalysis, as to convey the reality of his internal adventures and struggles. He is not just saying it, he is living it. But unless this reality can somehow be conveyed to others, it will be lost and of no use to future generations. It has to be made to look real so that people can identify with it, can stimulate their own imaginations and their own remembering processes. So this was the aim of the film, to make it look real, as the fictional characters whom Bion says kept his mind alive, deep in the realms of the unconscious, even when he was sure it must be dead from his incapacity to reorganize its domination by traumatic memories. So in a sense, the resemblances to the life and times of a man called Wilfred Bion are fortuitous, though provided by him in the hope of telling us something that lies beyond their face value, namely universal conflicts and directions in the psyche of every man. As he says at the beginning of The Long Weekend, if I could have resorted to abstractions, I would have done so. Unknowable knowledge can only intersect with everyday existence in the form of a fiction. So the idea of this film has been to clothe certain universal abstractions in the fictional guise of one individual and the dreams he has offered us so that we can dream them too. Thank you.
Thank you. So we move now to the response of Vera Montagna, who is a clinical psychologist, child psychotherapist, and psychoanalyst. She has worked at the psychiatry department of a public hospital in Sao Paulo, Brazil, and at the Children's Institute at the University of Sao Paulo. Her preclinical training was at the Department of Children and Parents at the Tavistock Clinic in London. And while in England, she was a psychotherapist at the Epsom Child Guidance Clinic in Surrey. She has been an effective member of the Brazilian Psychoanalytic Society of Sao Paulo, a member of the IPA Cultural Committee, and a member of the Documentation and Historical Research Department of the Sao Paulo Psychoanalytic Society. Besides her professional activity as a child and adult psychoanalyst, she has practiced the art of painting and engraving for almost 30 years, as well as studying art and psychoanalysis. Her published articles include Rembrandt, Resonances of a Self-Portrait for the Brazilian journal Psicanalyse et Culture, and Drawing and Its Variations for the Journal of Psychoanalysis of Brazil. Thank you, Vera.
Well, thank you, Alison. I would like to express my gratitude to Meg Williams for the invitation and the privilege of this conversation with her, Alison Vaz, Viviane Fasica, and everyone here. The purpose of this comment is to highlight some elements drawn from my personal experience as a reader and a viewer of two artistic works, Wilfred Bion's extraordinary autobiography, the trilogy A Memoir of the Future, and the impressive film The Becoming Room. We know our aesthetic sensibility is affected in a fulminating way by the mystery of a creative work. The unrest and the emotional charge of such experience not only provoke a destabilizing impact, but also add the propulsive force of a singular inner process to make new discoveries, to make room for new discoveries. How can you transform the singular subjective experience generated by such an unstable and elusive aesthetic object? We are born and die inside the symbolic field of a language, and language is used to transfigure and to create worlds. In this way, language gives us the many possibilities to express enchantment and disenchantment, joy and pain, coming from our emotional relationships. In addition to the possibility of expressing feelings, the life of intimate and emotional relationships was considered by Bion as the stage, the area of life in which the personality grows. So, Reading an autobiography may be considered as an intimate conversation with the author, not to transmit knowledge, facts of life, but to be an agent of change. Then it requires a receptive attitude to the unknown of the emotional experience that emerges from the intense and contradictory movements of the narrative. Additionally, the poetic language used by the writer instigates the capacity to observe. Then, fostering something new, a great book offers, according to Proust, the key to open the door deep inside us, opening to the vastness of oneself, to places we would not otherwise have known how to reach, going beyond what the reader is accustomed to apprehend. These considerations lead us to Meg Williams when she revisits Bion's memoir, maintaining in her film script the strong charge of mystery and enchantment, arisen from the extraordinary mobility of her aesthetic object. And this is not a simple purpose, because Meg, preserving the uniqueness of the author's poetic language to weave a film script, uses her own intuitions emerged from her deep knowledge of Bion's work. Then she establishes a lively conversation with this radical autobiography in the fine selections of some dialogues between the prenatal and the postnatal parts of the personality. And more, Meg shows with acuity her capacity to grasp the originality of this psychoanalyst's thought, attentively articulated to her extensive multidisciplinary studies. In fact, this is a remarkable example of aesthetic reciprocity, so I'll discuss it in The Apprehension of Beauty by Meg Williams and Donald Meltzer. Then, Meg also gives Bion's autobiography her own close reading, showing her ability to bring together and relate many contradictory emotional aspects of the narrative, following the author's purpose to write a book unspoiled of any tincture of common sense, reason, etc. Reading this autobiography and watching the film, we acknowledge the role irony plays, inviting the reader to follow the thread of his narrative with happy lunacy and relativistic fiction, quoting Bion. We are urged to think in multiple directions without any possibility of reason and certainty. Moreover, the mobility of the aesthetic object invites the audience to observe the wide variety of resonances coming from verbal and nonverbal communication. The ironic and provocative tone of this narrative generates an emotional atmosphere characterized by disturbing relationships with the status quo, inducing the reader to face the fission between one idea and another, one person and another, contradictory feelings raised between the reader's emotional experience and the thread of the narrative, kept in an incessant motion. The gaps and the constant instability of words, the agile mixture of contrasting ideas, creates a whirling rhythm in the mind of the audience, also promotes openings to imaginative life. The viewer observes the disruptive effects inside himself, attentive to other deeper levels of apprehension, which involves the capture of unexpected elements, the so-called wild birds of meaning using Meltzer's expression. Thus, a receptive attitude enables the reader to follow what's going on inside himself, and on the other hand, pursue how the poetic elements are tangled and entangled and disentangled to engender something unexpected, new and incongruous, reinforcing the beauty and the mysterious character of both memoir and film. This demands a struggle, a genuine movement to the heart of oneself. It is an aesthetic struggle within our infant mind to face a new language, which may provoke the emergence of unusual ideas, of ruins of primitive forms, words in form of free associations or in dreams. However, these intuitive new ideas involve emotional turbulence and its sufferings, coming from the tension and conflict between positive and negative emotionality, and need to be contained in order to not escape or be destroyed. Furthermore, this is not an automatic psychic achievement. To transform these ideas and their turbulences, we need to host and process them in a dreamy mind, as Bjorn said, by a thinking breast, through meditate love, in order to engender symbols and to develop further thoughts. Crossing the gap, or the caesure, results in the expansion of the infant ego, the learning from experience, a continuous and never-ending process of mental life. In the becoming room, the independent moments of the scenes are used as a metonymic procedure. By bringing together multiple voices of the characters and disparate elements, this technical procedure also opens to a metaphorical field that resembles Bakhtin's concept of a carnivalesque perception of the world, where it's possible to express a range of contradictory possibilities in constant motion. The film unsettles the viewer by shattering expectations, also generating a detached critical view. Thus, the watcher is thrown into a new emotional experience explored through a web, through the web of a character's voice and his dreamed autobiography. This polyphony the authors used to express contradictory feelings of beauty and joy, also his scars and terrors, the burden of abandonment, fantasies of a very frightening quality of his childhood, and other agonic duplications of the author's own consciousness. The polyphony is often expressed in caricatures dialogues that trigger an emotional experience of strangeness in the audience, threatened by the reification and by an apprehension of nonsense or absurdities of life. The capture of these surreal scenes stuns the viewer and immediately launches into another region of sensibility, creating an illusory space in which the boundaries between reality and imagination, life and death, past and future, individual and group, parts of the personality are abolished. Paradoxically, we realize that all the forms and all the symbols of carnivalized language are imbued not only with nonsense and strangeness, but with lyricism, alternations, and renewal. So, in this way, like in dream, they cease appearing contradictory. The surprise effect of these two artistic works subverts logical relations, opens cracks and instigates an awakening of attention to the musicality of the words, not as dead signs, but to give them life, to promote the resurrection of the word, using here an expression of Jorge Luis Borges. We know that poetic language is born from the persistent and incessant search for the words to engender the unthinkable, the irreplaceable poetic image, this mysterious transformation of the emotion in symbol. Thank you.
Thank you. Okay, so finally we hear Vivian Pasica's response. Vivian is a psychoanalyst and a member of the Toronto Psychoanalytic Society and the IPA, practicing in Toronto. She originally trained as a clinical psychologist in Dublin, Ireland. Her research at the University of Toronto explored the impact on the maternal holding function of revisiting primitive mental states in being intimately engaged with an infant's state of mind. She works in private practice with adults, children, adolescents, couples, and parent-infant dyads, and is actively involved in bringing psychoanalytic insights into the community. She is on the faculty at the Toronto Psychoanalytic Institute and is chair of the Between Hours Interdisciplinary Dialogues at the Toronto Psychoanalytic Society, a program that coordinates an annual symposium on applied psychoanalysis and which inaugurated Toronto's first Freud Cafe, now operating in the community since 2014. Thank you.
Thank you, Alison, and thank you, Meg, for this invitation. Beyond's A Memoir of the Future invites the reader to participate in the lived experience of the very developmental process he is attempting to convey in the text. The ongoing journey of coming to be one's authentic self and developing a thinking mind through intimate engagement, and the internal obstacles encountered along the way that thwart it. The narrative depicts a dream of this inner journey in the writer's mind, and it's through emotionally engaging the text that our own reverie potential is set in motion, offering the possibility of discovering something new of our own becoming through a reacquaintance with our primordial roots. What in the text and film are we being asked to bear witness to and to bear? The fictional format used by Bion brings to mind Joyce's Finnegan's Wake, which itself defies logic. Its inherent disorganization and chaotic arrangement arouse resistance and challenges the reader to find a way to endure the disorienting impact of being hurled into chaos and kept in the dark while being faced with the bombardment of the narrative's incoherence and emotional charge. This encounter with conflicting multiple vertices coming from different angles, converging and colliding all at once, sends us hurtling to find a through line, a structure to frame the chaotic, contradictory elements. The reader has to reconcile the dual challenge of abandoning oneself to the immediacy of being in the experience and discovering its essence, while resisting the urge to prematurely define it as a means to escape the feeling of being engulfed. For some time, one is submerged in the narrative's deep undercurrents, subject to unpredictable tidal turbulence without having access to an orienting compass with which to locate our bearings. Might this evocate the first sense of the infant being catapulted out of outer space without a spacesuit in search of a light or something continuous to hold on to hold its own nascent parts together, as described by Bick, or that of the mother herself immersed in the maternal waters of the early postpartum period, succumbing to momentary boundary diffusion to intuit what the baby needs, while also needing to keep a foot on solid ground. In Meg Harris-Williams' dramatization of Beyond's dream, the elusive quality of the unconscious is brought to life through her own characterization of its internal objects, interfacing through a kind of distorted inner speak in various discordant groupings or scenes across different dimensions that vitalizes our sense of being in the dream itself. Through their interplay, we are jabbed, moved, perturbed, not just by their words and the gaps between the words, but by the timbre and emotional tone of the voices as they rise and fall, and by the gradual build-up and crescendo of the felt caged-in feelings that reverberate in the face of every palpable strained effort to emancipate them. Even the muffled sound quality of the film that amplifies and fades lends to the subterranean feel of the inner world. We are at the same time jolted by the portrayal of the jagged, zigzagged movements across the developmental trajectory with its scarring, tearing at the fabric of the psyche and its strained tension between longing and constraint. Longing in the face of absence, the excruciating pain of parting, as in the opaque glass of the train window that shields emotion, and the abandonment to bear alone the intensity of the affect, the confusion, and the strangulated curiosity, as in the sexual researches, the pregnant pot. The untouchables and unspeakables are kept outside the constrictive walls of reasoned thought that break through time and again to haunt the psyche, drawing our attention to the very blindness to the infantile captured in Yeats' sardonic line, "What need have you to dread the monstrous crying of wind?" We are both pained and offended by the blindness, and yet we turn away from the chaos of the narrative itself. The vivid personification of aspects of the self in the film prompts an identification not just with the frustrated and imprisoned infantile self, but also with those parts compelled to flee the emotional upheaval, such that we meet head on our own censor. We too arch our mental apparatus outward towards obtaining some sense of organization in the name of trying to understand the bigger picture, the potential meaning, the meta meaning even, that amounts to a form of simultaneous telescoping in and out, in response perhaps to the impact of the shifting foregrounding, backgrounding effect, the reversible perspectives embedded in the script. The experience of engaging the narrative is one of being pulled in different directions all at once, the back and forth between primary and secondary process, between PS and D, caught in the dialectic between our own maternal and paternal functions, both compelling. It is this very tension and struggle to find a way to remain immersed in the chaotic aspects to discover something new that captures my attention. To endure it, I reach to the poets and to mythology. We are at one and the same time in Plato's cave and outside it, blind to what is before our eyes that we cannot yet fathom, and blinded by the intensity of the emotional bombardment, realizing at the same time that the shadows and what they reflect are only ever approximations of the truth. Can we stay in the dream to experience the forms without pushing too hard to realize them? Can momentary illuminations, sound bites of insight, sustain us on this journey? Who are our internal companions? I envisage as a framing structure the Neolithic passage tomb at Newgrange, whose construction predates the pyramids of Giza and Stonehenge. Here on the winter solstice, the light of the rising sun enters the portal above the entrance to illuminate the passage within, shedding light on the floor of the inner chamber, an illumination that lasts no more than 17 minutes. Pilgrims wait long hours in awe to catch a glimpse of this wonder. Can we wait with an open mind for the chance encounter of seeing what the momentary light of the morning sun might unveil? Newgrange, known as a brook, from the Irish brew, meaning womb, consists of three separate chambers off the central passage chamber, with the layout thought to have a resemblance to the female interior. Metaphorically speaking, then, within this matrix are the makings of generative possibility or claustral entrapment, thinking of Meltzer here. The ritual importance of the site is evidenced in the numerous references to it in Irish myths. The Tuatha De Danann, children of the goddess Dana, who ruled Ireland in ancient mythology and brought elements of civilization to the Irish mythological cycle, were said to have built Newgrange as a burial place for their deity, including one of its pre-Christian chiefs, Lug Lovfather, which is Lug of the Long Arm, Celtic god of sun and light and spiritual father of the great mythical hero Cú Chulainn, who himself was thought to have been conceived there by his mother, Dectine, when Lug visited her in a dream while she slept. The epic legendary tale, Toinbo Culenya, talks or tells of the brave Cú Chulainn, who already by age 7 had obtained hero status and single-handedly held off Queen Maeve's invading army to secure victory of Ulster, now Northern Ireland. We also hear something of what lies beneath this fierce exoskeletal structure in the wasting sickness of Cú Chulainn, which tells of a curse befalling the warrior, his falling ill for a year, for his attack on a pair of swans, female underworld symbols, while trying to obtain their feathers to adorn and impress his wife, Ymir. There ensued an intense love entanglement with one of these underworld women that left the hero bereft while sparking jealousy in Ymir. There are many legendary accounts as to his eventual recovery from this sunken retreat. This mythical legend or mythological legend itself, a symbol, takes us to the nexus of psychic tension within the maternal matrix and opens out the possibility of seeing the universal, the multiplicity in the individual experience. The relevance of the Trinity to Bion's concept of birth of a thinking mind through its sojourn in the mind of the other, the three chambers of the cave, Cú Chulainn's triangulation, and the blush on the uterus wall already marking a passionate union, lies in his view of the Oedipal myth as a container of an emotional experience that permits its apprehension. It reminds us that the father as other is already present in the mind of the mother, her own paternal function, and in the infant psyche through the felt gaps in their union. To walk inside this passage tomb is to be moved by the echoed silence that reverberates with the feel of blood pulsating through the veins of an entire generation with its mythical past emanating through the cave walls. like the transformative potential offered in the momentary merger states experienced in the early postpartum period, this encounter too holds transcendent possibility. In this cave where myths abound, I am in good company and have faith that the light will eventually appear and bear fruit. Bion's memoir presents us with his own mythic narrative, itself a trilogy whose initial amorphous form is gradually given shape over the course of the three-volume text. Birth and death, of growth of the thinking self, are presented as one and the same and come full circle in the narrative, with the prenatal beginning and return to primordial beginnings reflected in the film's format. Retrospectively, we can trace the unsequenced progression from the initial war between psyche and soma over whether the essence of experience can ever be grasped and represented through the raw, undifferentiated doublespeak and overspeak between the different parts of the personality, with one voice drowning out the other at vital junctures. The rupturing prompting our own rejigging, until finally there is a coming together of the parts as portrayed in the emergence of a more coherent, Socratic-like dialogue that now champions questioning over knowing, itself giving way to a return to beginnings, to the formless unity in oneness, the ineffable, and a folding back upon the self with a new calmness in reconnecting with, in quotes, the spark of sincerity buried underneath all that rubble. In engaging the text, Bion had urged the reader, analyst, to pause, not close in too soon, but rather to wait without any irritable reaching after fact and reason, Keith's negative capability, for the possibility of a momentary illumination to arise. He remained wary of the use of words to capture the essence of experience and drew inspiration from the ancient mystics and poets whom he felt intuitively grasped this tension. Arriving at knowing for the poet Rilke entails more than experiencing, but rather a progression from feeling through experiences through forgetting, what he called blood remembering. To quote Rilke, it is not yet enough to have the memories. One must be able to forget them when they are many, and one must have the great patience to wait until they come again. For it's not yet the memories themselves, not till they have turned to blood within us, to glance and gesture, nameless and no longer to be distinguished from ourselves. Not till then can it happen that in a most rare hour, the first word of a verse arises in their midst and goes forth from them. The form of engagement that Bion had in mind was to listen to our own spontaneous thoughts that arise in our own listening, so as not to close in too soon and restrict thinking. In speaking of the gestalt that gradually takes shape in the reader's mind through such engagement, Grotstein in Vermoti offered the image of an archipelago, a group of islands that, while seeming disconnected to the naked eye, are actually connected and form part of the same geological terrain beneath the ocean's surface. The reward in waiting is seen as coming to see that we don't ultimately get to the answer, but to another open question, which further expands the growth of the thinking mind. Thank you.
Thank you. And thank you all. Found myself thinking about the three of you and your three presentations as separate but making up a kind of work, like a work of music, in the way that you process your experience very beautifully. So I know we've got about 10 minutes now. And I, thinking about that, and thinking about music and about the art and the visual imagery and the poetry, I wondered if Meg might say something about Bion and the arts. I know they were important to him. I think I know he painted. But I wonder if you might say something more about that.
Probably just what I think we all sort of know very well, which is that he kept feeling frustrated about possibilities of expression and of getting his own meaning across to himself as well as to other people. And hence his great sort of love and respect for the arts, which he felt could capture, you know, what Vera says, these wild birds of meaning, that they could do it, and how on earth could he do it? And yet I think in his autobiography, he does actually do it, but in a way that is kind of a bit rough-edged and open-ended, and really almost invites people to sort of dive in and not exactly steal some of his wonderful images or modes of expression, but to sort of kind of build on them. And as I think, you know, like Vera and Vivian have done so beautifully in terms of going off in such a personal way and bringing in these, it's making the links across the caesura, you know, it's bringing more than one thing together and kind of adding one's appreciation of what Bion has offered to one's own internal objects and a capacity for linking. Now, those two things have to be married too, at least, or more than two. And I kind of think that Bion would have approved of the exercise, whether, it doesn't matter whether he agreed or not, but I think he would just have been very happy that this kind of thing was being done with the dreams that he's been offering, and that people are building on them, because he said, you know, dreams should be generative. And that's what art forms could do. And can that be done in psychoanalysis? I think he thought it could, but it's very difficult to get it across. I feel that sort of this little group that we've been having a series of meetings building up to this. It's kind of enriched the whole thing for me a lot. And I'm just kind of astounded in the ways that people have sort of have brought these caesuras and brought their own experience into it, to make something new, which is sort of ongoing, which is what it was meant to be, the becoming room, is, you know, like a lifetime experience. You can go on.
I'm thinking about what struck me, you know, in listening to your response, Vera, the gaps, the fission, as you put it, the cracks, the ruptures, the absence felt, you know, itself prompts an opening, making room for the new thought. Like, as you put it, the poetic elements are tangled and disentangled to engender something unexpected. It's what the film and the memoir invited us to participate in, or what the infant has to struggle with, this aesthetic struggle within the infant and within our infant mind, I think you put it, Vera. Make me think of Leonard Cohen's lyrics in his song Anthem from the 1992 album, The Future, interestingly. The lines of that, forget your perfect offering. There is a crack in everything. That's how the light gets in. It's kind of this exercise that we're engaged in, that we're invited to be engaged in.
Yeah, so what BM calls psyche lodgement. He says you've got to leave a roughness on the surface. Don't let your knowledge be too smooth. Leave a roughness there, a psyche lodgement, which you get by bringing things together, sort of surfaces together, and there's a roughness there.
And I think that the importance of gaps and fission at you pointed, Meg and Viviane also, I think it's a big thing for every person, because you are there and you have to find your own way out. Nobody will give you an answer how to do it. You have to face it, and to face your turbulences, your sufferings, everything, and to put your mind to think. And this is something that appears so simple, but at the same time is very complex, because you have to be patient, as you said, Meg, be patient with oneself to realize what's going on, and to give you time to think and to bring your own thoughts. Yeah. I think this is the most important thing. You have to be patient and have to have courage to face it. So that's the point, and that's the beautiful thing when you realize that it's not that suffering, but you realize that you can do something about it by your own, you know, with, you know, trying to, I think trying to bring your own repertoire, your own experience, deep experience inside yourself.
Yeah, so what he calls waiting for the underlying pattern to emerge. And I suppose there has to be kind of some reward for it, so it's not just torment all the time. It has to be, I suppose that's the aesthetic thing, is that when these things come together, if you wait for a pattern to emerge, there is something aesthetic, something harmonious that eventually does come out of these rough edges. And that's kind of your reward for it. even though it's difficult, you get something out of it.
that kind of transcendent moment when it comes together, it just comes together out of the blue. There it is. You can have it in a moment with a baby. You can have it at a moment in the session, or just even in this exercise. I was thinking how we talk about the usefulness in psychoanalytic training of going through infant observation exercises to help do this very thing, to just sit with the unknown and be moved with it, to see what arises. But this memoir offers the same possibility. I was thinking, what a useful thing that would be, to have to read this at the beginning of a training to throw you into the very experience of having to sit with the unknown and work with it and wait and see what arises. It offers this potential so beautifully.
But it gives you something to work on, doesn't it? You can't just be flailing around in the unknown without any way of working at it. Whereas if you can sort of bring your own experience into it, you know, finding a sort of congruence with it, and you think, oh, this is actually about me, not just about Beyond, then it gets more rewarding.
I think the same could be true of this discussion, but we have to bring this part of the session to a close, sadly. But hopefully it will continue. First, I need to thank you all for being so generous to bring yourselves to this Congress. And then I need to say to the audience that if you would like to offer your own responses and to hear those of others, to please put your name in the chat box. And you will then be added to a Zoom call through the Congress platform where this discussion can continue. Thank you.
Thank you, Alison.
Thank you.
Thank you.